You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
To this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Hale, and with me, as usual, is Brandon. Today, we're actually doing a review of a YouTube video. Now, before that sounds a little bit too odd and you switch the channel, it's a little bit more than just your standard YouTube video. It's actually a piece that's really been popping off lately, well, in a bunch of different spheres of media. It's by a creator called The Elephant Graveyard, who is Canadian, as far as we know, and does a lot of comment ostensibly about the comedy scene, the world comedy scene, and what's going on with that. They're quite funny videos. They're very satirical. They're very stylized in a very unique way. We really suggest you check it out. It's The Elephant Graveyard. He has a whole bunch of different content. However, there are obviously a lot more. We wouldn't just be talking about a regular comedy video on this show. That's not really what it's about. A lot of his videos, well, basically all of them, deal deeply with issues of like philosophical issues, issues of psychology, societal issues, sociological, all this kind of stuff. It's really at the bedrock of his sorts of like analysis and the sort of artistic style that he's using. And so we thought that the video would actually be a great way to introduce and examine a couple philosophical concepts that are really, I think, essential and important and super interesting. And he does a really good job of illuminating them. So we thought that reviewing this video and discussing it would be an awesome way to get at some concepts, some philosophical ideas that are normally pretty difficult to penetrate because they can be quite complex. Now, before we get there, let's do our little opener that we've been doing for a little while now. You listeners may be aware of our little quote and quandary. Today, I've got a quandary. Brandon's got a quote.
This is actually from Donald Winnicott, who was a British psychoanalyst circa 30s into the 50s. And he says, "We are poor indeed if we are only sane." That sounds really... There's one way of interpreting that is as a kind of romanticism of the irrational, that there's some value to insanity. I think that there's a temptation to view, you know, the grass on the other side as being a bit greener, that there's something disinhibited about insanity or madness. But as it turns out, Winnicott's not actually talking about insanity, but the what he calls the true self, the spontaneous principle of creativity, and that sanity or the guise of sanity going into life kind of guided or purely reactionary, kind of just logically anticipating the world and meeting it where it meets you, that can inhibit creativity in a certain way. I think going into this episode, we'll see, just to anticipate a little bit, we'll see people who are doing things because these are the sane things to do. They meet the world, they meet a crazy world, and they have these perfectly rational responses to the world within the narrow kind of confines that they see, and they can justify themselves as being sane. This is the sane thing to do, but actually it robs them of something, and Winnicott would call that spontaneity, their true self, etc.
Yeah, I think to kind of allude a little bit, like that was a great quote, and to kind of allude a little bit to the episode as well, it's, you know, we're going to be talking a lot about how people can adopt individual and especially like group modes of thought and perspective, and that those, you know, those seem sane because they are they at least ostensibly on the surface are structurally very stable. There's a cost to that commitment. There's a cost to the sanity that is a rejection of, like you're saying, of maybe it's your authentic self, it's creativity, it's intellectual flexibility. But if I make a commitment to a particular ideology, worldview, community, or just some image that I have of who I am, you know, I might I might, without even realizing it, be giving up far more than I. My quandary is related to, very much related to what we're going to be talking about today. And it's less a quandary, more a thought that I had, or kind of realization, or a sort of line in the sand that I'm drawing. Many times I've struggled to talk, like to figure out a phrase for when I'm just loosely talking about technology, media, mediums, all this kind of stuff, really the stuff that you and I and you, the listener, interact with all the time, whether it be on your smartphone or the devices in your car or your computer, or what you see on the TV or what you've got with your earbuds in, or all this kind of stuff, tech and this medium. And late, I had heard this term before, but it got reintroduced to me. The term new media is sometimes used to kind of be a broad stroke of all that kind of stuff. I'm going to call it present media. So going forward through episodes, if you ever hear me use the term present media, that is just very loosely talking about all sort of media, technology, entities, and activities that have been integrated into our regular daily lives at this point. And the reason I choose the term present media, because listeners might be more familiar with the term new media and old media. Old media is usually like typographic media, that kind of stuff, right? Like, you know, books, newspapers, all this kind of stuff. Could even go back further, but just the plain old written word, whatever it's going to be. But, you know, I'm using the term present media because I think personally that the term new media sort of obviously indicates that, like, there's, you know, this sort of stuff that we're dealing with is on the horizon. Whereas I think it's very much the case that this revolution in media is here. It actually happened a while ago. We crossed the horizon some time ago, and we're living in this new media, or this present media world. And I also want to use the term present media because I think, you know, as people who are interested in doing philosophy and thinking about culture and society and all this kind of stuff in these sorts of ways, that also indicates to us, well, if this is present media, what is new media going to look like, right? What is that world going to be? And maybe it gives us a little bit of a kick in the butt to start examining, okay, well, what is the actual new media? Like, what is at the cutting edge of the media, the medium landscape, the technology landscape, and also not just the technology landscape, but the relationship with technology that we're seeing in culture and with individuals and that kind of stuff as well. Present media, that's the term. I'm coining it. I'm sure someone else has already come up with it. It's pretty obvious.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing about the term new media is that in a certain way, just by virtue of the speed or the pace at which these things are moving, the term new media is already kind of antiquated. Like, if you think about people or commentators talking about new media, one of the new media that they might be discussing is something like television, right? Well, if you think about television habits from between, you know, the 2000s and the 2020s, those habits have completely changed, right? Like, we still watch television. Like, we plenty of us still have TV screens in our, you know, main living rooms, or even maybe in our own living rooms or in our own bedrooms or something like that. But the way that we engage with those televisions is totally different. In fact, almost no one analyzes TV according to the television set itself. The shift is from the way that the programming is done, right? So, as you know, in the 2000s, you know, everyone would sit down and watch their serial, like their TV series. But now, Netflix and stuff like that, streaming has changed how we work with TVs. So new media kind of is a term that is trying to talk about the TV per se. I think you could have like a similar kind of an antiquated analysis of video games, where people are talking about the video games as the medium of interactivity. Okay, that might be true, but there's so many different platforms for these video games now that that's kind of what's the relevant thing. And platforms themselves may be something like present media in that regard. And we need new language to talk about these new forms of, or I should say, present forms of media.
Yeah, you know, and we can easily get kind of, when examining these sorts of things, when we do a sort of philosophical investigation, a theoretical investigation, we can get kind of stuck in our old time or what went before, even when we're trying to talk about the present or the future. You know, the example that I think immediately of is the work that we've covered on the on the show before and has been brought up a few times, which is Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death, a book that I really recommend to any listeners. But it's a funny book because Neil Postman wrote that in the, I think it was 1984 or something like that, 1985. He was writing about television, right? He was writing about the television era, that kind of new media. But yet a lot, you could literally like delete the word TV and insert the word like smartphone or social media or whatever into that text, and it would read almost better than it would about TV. Postman was accumulating and understanding media in a way that was more ahead of his time than I think he realized, but was stuck very much on that kind of dealing with like the past, you know, the little past material physical media. Anyways, speaking of present media, using my term, let's dive into it. So the YouTube video, just for you, to remind our listeners, is done by the Elephant Graveyard. That's the channel. He does a bunch of different stuff. I'm not getting into it a lot. It's basically all great. It's interesting. It's artistic. It's very philosophical. It's a lot of fun. It's very funny. Very satirical sense of humor. Very dry. But the actual video that we're going to be discussing today that's been kind of making waves online is how comedy was destroyed by an anti-reality doomsday cult. If you want to go look it up, how comedy was destroyed by an anti-reality doomsday cult. And to give a very brief synopsis before we get into the actual like ideas more that we want to tackle, this is actually a part of a series examining Joe Rogan, who's the kind of king of podcasting and a very big person in the media landscape now, like one of the biggest, a very big name in the political landscape as well, for multiple reasons that I'm sure we'll touch on. And also ostensibly like into comedy, like that was his, like Joe Rogan's big thing was always that he was a comedian, he's a real comedian, and as he would say, and you know, and he basically, you know, a lot of this examination is how like the comedy sphere that Joe has created and structured is very low quality. Like the people, like both himself and the people associated with him, are comedically, the Elephant Graveyard would say, and I personally would agree, and I think a lot of other people agree, judging by how well this video has done and this sort of other commentary and discussion going online. Because I should say, the Elephant Graveyard is not the only person who's making content about this and sort of pointing this whole out. He's just doing it in a very unique and in-depth and philosophically, psychologically minded way. He's doing it in a way that no one else is, but there's plenty of other comedians, podcasters who are coming out now basically being like, and a lot of them are actually referencing the Elephant Graveyard in their criticisms, but basically saying that Joe Rogan and his like comedy team that he's assembled are primarily like low quality, lack skill, aren't funny, and there's something else kind of going on there that has other origins and stuff like that. With that being said, we don't want to get too much into like the whole strand of like explaining the lore behind the video and all that kind of stuff, because really, like, if you want to go watch that, you should. We really encourage you to engage with this content if that's your thing. However, if you've decided to become a Luddite, I fully respect that and don't want to engage with any content. Maybe even this radio show is too much for you. Totally respect that. I get it. But if you are on YouTube, we really recommend you look this up and watch the other videos in this kind of series as well. But the reason we wanted to bring this video up is because it goes into two philosophical ideas. There's other ones as well, and we'll kind of touch on them. But two major philosophical ideas that are really interesting and really interestingly laid out within the context of this video. More or less, Jean Baudrillard's, who was a French philosopher's, idea of the simulacrum or the hyper real. How do you say simulacrum? Is it simulacrum? This is probably the philosophical idea that is most essential to the video. We can create, both with ourselves and with our communities, a vision or an understanding of the world, an ideology, a lens, or whatever you want to call it, that can sort of drape over reality, as the Elephant Graveyard would describe, as classic reality. That's like the base, that's, you know, being in touch with like truth, you know, just like what is, and instead you're going to drape over this basically a fantasy of some kind or other to effectively cope with classic reality.
Yeah, I think that's the important thing, too, that you've positioned hyperreality in relation to what the Elephant Graveyard is calling classical reality. We might also say consensus reality, because I think the consensus is that the hyperreality is not really real. It has a kind of intelligible, self-containing logic that structures the truths that one enters into and can kind of discern only according to the rules or the logic of that particular hyperreality. But that's what's characteristic of the hyperreality, is that, first of all, it stands in some relation to common reality or classical reality. You have to exit classical reality because it's a response to it, as we'll see. The other thing too is it's structured in a certain way, right? In order to address the truths that are in classical reality. And as you use the word cope, that's the word that the Elephant Graveyard uses as well. It is essentially a way of coping with certain truths in classical reality.
Well, I think, so let's talk about like cope a little bit more, but also too, within the context of cope, this essential human aspect that the Elephant Graveyard really touches on to really get into this movement. How do we make the transition, as Elephant Graveyard would commonly say, to a whole new guy? How do you become a whole new guy? And the first thing he really touches on is migration. This idea. So, and as he kind of funnily puts it, at some point, every person who's ever moved or trying to become a new guy has looked around and said, I got to get the hell out of here, right? And he goes on to say that it's that migration is baked into human DNA, right? That it's that we, that all of us, that at some level or other, will experience this sense of, I'm looking around at the world, I'm looking at who I am, and I think to myself, I got to get the hell out of here.
Yeah. I always, when I encountered that in that video, and I thought about it in terms of the other concepts that he's bringing up, and the fact that he's probably encountered the actual philosophers that kind of espouse or like structure these concepts, the I gotta get the hell out of here gene for me was kind of like a popularized way of talking about the sort of transcendence, this idea that we really are more than we are, that we're always kind of moving into the future, that any kind of essential core that we have is one that transcends itself, right? We're always projecting into the future, constructing new things. And though I liked the way that he kind of, because when existentialists talk about it, it can get kind of abstract and, heretically metaphysical. But I like how the Elephant Graveyard just confines it to a guy. The thing that you're trying to get the hell out of is, first of all, your world in a certain way. So like sometimes people are just like, I got to get the hell out of here. So they move from LA to Austin. But the other one is they try to become a new guy. They have some self-conception of themselves. And they say, well, if I was just different, I would get the hell out of whatever, I got to get the hell out of before. It's actually kind of funny. That I mentioned Winnicott with my quote before. The other thing he says too is when you can't change the world, the only thing you can change is yourself. And that's how you get, compliance and stuff like that. When you're completely hopeless or powerless to change your environment, you can suit yourself to that environment. And the whole point is just the relief of some kind of tension, just got to get the hell out of here.
Yeah. We had that pent up anxiety. I got to get the hell out of here. And that I really like how you said it. It's like you can kind of there's the classic existential kind of like authentic view of that, which is like, you sort of discover who you really are. Right. And you go on, some sort of journey, whether it's internal, physical, whatever. And you kind of like you take stock of reality, of classic reality, and the sets of possibilities ahead of you. And you authentically you know, take hold of your options and opportunities. You take responsibility. That's what I was looking for. And you kind of move forward with that. That's not really what the Elephant Graveyard is focusing on here, because there's a flip side of that, which is where we get to the hyperreal simulacrum, which is you kind of, you use the word, not obedience, but basically that where you can, the other option is compliance. You can step into a whole new system. Or alternatively, if you have the material resources and the power and all this kind of stuff, you can create a whole new system, a whole new simulacrum, and invite others to join. Or in the process of making that, you pull other people into it and make it a whole new world, a whole new thing, a whole new vibe that everyone is kind of sharing in. So basically, we talk about migration. You're gonna migrate from classic reality to a hyper reality. Or in the video, you're saying that's kind of like what Joe Rogan has done. I think it's worth talking about specifically with the hyperreal simulacrum, the relationship to technology, because that's huge within the context of this topic in this video, for obvious reasons, which is all of the people that we are discussing and all this whole world that we're kind of being involved in, and the one that Elephant Graveyard is examining, is a techno world. And the shift, the simulacrum shift, is a thoroughly, basically almost completely technological shift. It even brings up the fact, you know, was that Marshall McLuhan in the actual video? He has a clip of a guy talking about how the new media becomes the, like, the person's eye, right? And, you know, and this is the point where it becomes, you know, the kind of famous, I've heard this before, but basically, like, the like online becomes more real than reality, right? If you're terminally online, if your activities are happening online, if your communications are happening online, if the information you're putting out into the world, and more importantly, the information that you're probably absorbing, or probably the equal weight, but whatever, that you're absorbing is a consistently kind of like online sort of world thing, well, that space becomes more real than classic reality, if that's what you're involved in, if that's what you're doing.
The Elephant Graveyard does center technology, and I think rightly so, as the mechanism, or as the current mechanism for kind of, he makes this really subtle, it's not subtle, but I think it gets passed over and it's not emphasized enough in the video, that there are people who exploit that gene, the I gotta get the hell out of here gene, right? Migrations of people going somewhere, and then someone says, huh, a bunch of people are getting the hell out of here to go to there. Well, I can do something with that, right? Like, that's a lot of energy being spent to do that. You know, people have aspirations that you can kind of prey on and stuff like that. And I think that obviously he talks about the role of technology and that as well, but the fact that there are actual actors behind this, right? And this is the thing that's interesting. Maybe he does kind of emphasize it a little bit, because I remember when he there's the one edit where when he brings up Peter Thiel, there's actually a subtitle that says Peter Thiel is real, like he's a real guy. And this is the other thing that I actually like about this too, is that when you are reading existential philosophy and you're kind of seeing that push to transcendence, that we are always more than we really are, that we're always, you know, projecting ourselves into our possibilities and whatnot. Again, it gets really abstract and it gets kind of like pseudo metaphysical in a certain way that I think existentialists would be uncomfortable being received. The Elephant Graveyard is great because the people who are kind of creating that technology that exploits that are themselves a guy. If people are like, I want to be this guy, or I need to become like a new guy, well, guess what? He talks about the techno wizards, the illusion techno wizards who are constructing these hyper realities, and those themselves are a guy. So in a certain way, it's been brought down to this level of like, the transcendent, or the people who are manipulating this transcendence, are themselves actors, right? There's no supernatural intervention here. Like, this is all completely intelligible. It's all material. It's all something that you can interact with. Peter Thiel is real, you know, which I thought was a good kind of way to, it rounds out the analysis really well.
I don't know who Peter Thiel is. Peter Thiel is he's the CEO or head of Palantir, whatever, which is one of the world's largest corporations, but it is particularly a corporation that is heavily involved in the media industry, defense industry, in stuff like, you know, technology around, you know, weaponry, but also heavily involved in surveillance and kind of online technology type stuff. Very powerful company that has its hands in all sorts of aspects of government, heavy partnerships with things like, you know, organizations like the FBI and the CIA and the military industrial complex and blah, blah, blah. We sound like conspiratorial, but the point is, like, this is a real person who is really powerful and is operating strings that can have very real consequences and influences on the lives of everyday individuals, and can also, and is also clearly someone who has, just like any sort of new guy, like Peter Thiel became his new guy, and what his vision is, he has his own motivations that are, you know, clearly not, like, I think it's fair to say, probably not necessarily aligned with the wants and desires and, you know, ideological pursuits of, like, most people. This is, like, someone who lives in their own, very much in their own simulacrum, as we'll kind of, like, get into. But I think that's worth, it's worth jumping into that as we get into, okay, well, what makes, like, a simulacrum work from, like, Jean Baudroyd's view, but also kind of more laid out with the elephant graveyard here. Like, what is it about a simulacrum that works? Like, obviously there's, you know, you have people who are, you know, they look around classic reality, or perhaps they look at some sort of other simulacrum they're already in. They go, I got to get the hell out of here. We attract, and there's a new formation going on. In this case, the video is primarily focused on the simulacrum of the kind of Rogan sphere, the comedy sphere. And he makes the, I think, pretty obvious perspective or point that they, a simulacrum in many cases functions a lot like a cult, like an enclosed cult-like system. In the case of Rogan, it's very obviously kind of cult-like, because if anyone's sort of familiar with that comedy scene, he's very much the leader. He's like the center, he's the center guy, the central figure in that system. And, you know, he kind of points out that there's multiple pillars to kind of maintaining that system, right? If you're going to join any simulacrum, I don't want to use the term, I'll use the term join a simulacrum for now, but it's more like, I think people get more absorbed than anything, rather than actually signing up. But much like a cult, they have similar pillars. To go through the pillars really, really quickly, or not super quickly, but basically he maps out four pillars of any simulacrum, of any system that uphold. And actually, you know what, before we get into the pillars really quick, I want to talk about, he talks about Elon Musk briefly, because Elon Musk is another one of these sort of like techno wizard type guys. But he uses Elon as an example, if anyone sort of follows current news, of someone who kind of crashed and burned a little bit. Like, here's another techno wizard. Here's a guy with a lot of material power, a lot of technical power, a lot of social power, a lot of financial power, a lot of connections. All, you know, however you want to measure power, this guy has a lot of it. But what he lacks is charisma. He lacks self-awareness. He lacks a certain degree of self-control. And effectively, he's fumbled building his own simulacrum. He's fumbled building, you know, he kind of, the Alpha Graveyard talks about how, like, his whole thing, and I kind of even remember this 10 years ago or so, was like, he's going to be the new tech, you know, superstar guy, that he's actually like a good guy. He's going to take us to Mars. He's going to, like, you know, and it's this kind of vision of, like, he sees himself as this sort of, like, super tech wizard dude who's going to take people to, like, the next stage. He's going to be the leader on the next great migration out of, like, this terrible classic reality that he hates and all his followers hate. But he basically blew that up.
He's a good kind of negative example, this goes to the humor of the Elephant Graveyard as well, is that here you have the richest man on earth who has every resource in order to enact the migration into his own hyper reality to actually he's in the best position to get the hell out of here, but he's failed. Nobody is buying into it. Nobody, like, there are people who are